Hello, listeners. Welcome to Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, voting. We've got more primaries, and we know you love it. Pennsylvania, Nebraska, Idaho, and Oregon held primaries this week, and they offered some clues about where the Democratic Party stands right now. We will tell you what you need to know about that and also talk a little bit about what is coming up this next week, because as we've been talking about all this month, we are in this week-by-week-by-week spate of primaries right now. Plus, we are going to talk about Robert Mueller's investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election. It hit the one-year mark this week. Feels like it's been longer, but 1 year. We're going to talk a little bit more about what's going on in that, what we know so far, and what, if anything, to expect going forward. A reminder to our listeners to subscribe to the Nerdcast, rate us, and write a review, and stay tuned for the end of the show for a contribution from one of the Nerdcast's biggest fans. One more note before we begin, we are taping this a little bit before noon Eastern on Thursday, May 17th, so it is all up to date as of then. All right, let's get started. I want to welcome our guests. We have Charlie Mattesian, Politico's senior politics editor and Pennsylvania native and enthusiast.
Hey Charlie. Hey, Scott.
And we have Elena Schneider, who is joining us on the line from Texas, which has primaries next week. Elena, thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to jump into Texas in a little bit, but first, let's talk about what happened this Tuesday. Our first data point, zero. That is the number of women in Congress from Pennsylvania currently, a number that is going to be going up perhaps quite a bit at the beginning of next year. We'll talk a little bit about why it was another good night for Democratic women running for office. And the night also provided some more clues about what's going on within the Democratic Party right now in Pennsylvania, but also in Nebraska, as Democrats look to take back the House in November. So, Elena, give us kind of a top-line takeaway from Tuesday night. What, where does the battle for the House stand right now? What did we learn on Tuesday about that and about kind of what's going on within the Democratic Party right now?
Just a few questions, just a few top-line answers for that. So I think we took away a couple of things from Pennsylvania and Nebraska, the two key states where we were watching for primaries on Tuesday. One of which is that progressives can win in these primaries, and we're probably going to see more of this. Brad Ashford, who's a former member of Congress who lost in 2016 in Nebraska, he was a blue dog Democrat, somebody who is very much a moderate by and large when he was serving in Congress, and he faced a primary challenge from the left in Kara Eastman, who ran a true blue progressive campaign calling Ashford out for the various sort of places in which he wasn't in lockstep with sort of the left-wing part of the party, and she won, granted by just a handful of votes, but at the same time being able to do that in which she had a huge uphill climb to make with name recognition, reaching out to voters as a first-time candidate. She was able to beat basically someone who had the advantages of incumbency supporting him. So that's a really striking result that people in Washington were certainly watching and keeping an eye on, but I think that the idea that she actually was able to pull it off is one to watch and one for other maybe centrist Democrats to really keep an eye on.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting beforehand. It seemed like people were saying, like, oh, yeah, we got to keep an eye on the margin here because, you know, that'll show just how much energy is on the left in these primaries right now. And turns out the margin was a majority.
Right, exactly. And I think for Democrats going forward, that's one that they need to watch for. Even if the sort of quote-unquote more moderate Democrat gets through in some of these primaries, they've got some healing to do. They've got some work to do on bringing their party together. And granted, they are heading into a year in which people are pretty motivated to vote for a Democrat sort of regardless of who the Democrat is. It doesn't mean that you can't sort of ignore bringing that party together.
And Charlie, in your home state in the Lehigh Valley, we saw another example of a well-known Democrat, probably more conservative Democrat than Ashford, in John Morganelli, who's a district attorney in the 7th district there, overcome by a woman running to his left in that Democratic primary.
Right. I don't think it was a great night for moderate Democrats, whether you're talking about Ashford or Morganelli in that Lehigh Valley-based district. I mean, the tides in the Democratic Party are moving against moderates to begin with, and especially moderates like Morganelli. I mean, he's not especially hostile to Donald Trump. He had some...
Not only is he not hostile to Donald Trump, he was tweeting at him about potential jobs in the administration.
Exactly. And then there were other positions, too, whether you're talking about abortion or immigration, where he's out of step with progressives in that party. So it was, I think, a real uphill lift for him. But the real problem Democrats will face, though, I think, in that district is that it's not a highly progressive district. I mean, it is a competitive district still, even if it leans Democratic. And it was very comfortable with a candidate like Charlie Dent, who was sort of a moderate Republican, moderate to conservative Republican. And so, you know, the question will be whether Susan Wild will be the kind of fit for that district.
And that's a question in Nebraska, too, right, Elena?
It's absolutely a question about Nebraska. I think I would argue, though, that Susan Wild, although certainly running to the left of Morganelli, I don't think that was too difficult to do. And second, she's somebody who, when I spent time with her, I went canvassing with her in West End, Allentown. And a number of times people would ask her about sort of her progressive views and her electability. And more often than not, she talked about how she wanted to be a consensus builder. And that is different than the way that Kara Eastman has talked about it. And it's not to say that Kara would not be able to do that or pivot towards that in the general election. But Susan was sort of always running a bit more of a maybe mainstream Democratic campaign, even if her issues certainly were more progressive than Morganelli's. And also another thing to think about in Pennsylvania was that Greg Edwards, who was another candidate in the 7th District, who did run more like Kara in a, you know, a very left-leaning campaign in which he had Bernie Sanders' support, he lost. And he certainly got, I think, not quite a quarter of the electorate, but I think just around 20%. So clearly those voters are there, but he wasn't actually able to prevail in that district.
I want to talk briefly about safe seats on May 15th that we saw. Elena, we talked about at the top of the segment, Pennsylvania has no women in federal office right now. That's going to change, not just because of Susan Wild potentially winning a battleground seat, but what we saw in some of the safe seats in the Philadelphia metro area.
That's right. So there were a number of different open seats thanks to redistricting, which sort of reshuffled the map, moved different members around, and also we saw triggered a couple of retirements. So we've got two women who seem primed to head into Congress, Madeline Dean, a state legislator, and Mary Scanlon, a former school board member. They both won their respective primaries in these newly sort of pretty heavily Democratic seats in the Philadelphia suburbs. So you never know, but it seems pretty likely that those two will probably be heading to Washington. And that will break, as you say, the all-male hold on the delegation. Obviously, Wild is also running in a seat that Democrats feel like they might be able to pick up as well.
Charlie, I could see the excitement on your face as we're talking about Metro Philadelphia to just jump in and say your piece.
Well, I'm keeping my mouth shut because you guys know how I feel about Pennsylvania 5, the Delaware County District. I think everybody's off base on the idea that it's a strongly Democratic seat. I mean, I'm in the minority here. You know, I'm not saying you guys are wrong. I'm in the minority. I think people, having grown up there, I can tell you, even under its current lines, it's not really a lockdown Democratic district. There is a very strong Republican heritage there, a Republican machine that's in tatters, but it's still there. It is not a party that I think it is not an area that's extremely progressive. There are some parts of it that are. I think what the difference is, though, the numbers have been skewed by Hillary Clinton's performance there.
And she won by 28 points.
Yeah, she ran very, very well there, in part because the Philadelphia suburbs, and here I'm talking about the big four counties. You know, whether you're talking about Bucks, Montgomery, Delaware County, or Chester, all of them reacted pretty strongly against Trump to a varying degree. And Delco was among those. You know, Trump just does not play well in those kinds of suburban districts. And so I think many people are under the impression that that is a lockdown Democratic district. And I think while I think that Mary Scanlon, as Elena just said, is likely to take that seat, I don't think that that is something that we should be considering going forward over, until the next redistricting round as something that is a lockdown Democratic opportunity.
And Republicans, I will say, are super jazzed about Pearl Kim, who is the Republican nominee there. Woman, a former senior deputy attorney general running there. So it's one that they at least feel like they've got a good candidate in place for it.
and one who does not sound particularly Trump-like in background. Elena, take us into next week, May 22nd. We've got Arkansas, we've got Georgia, we've got Kentucky, and we've got Texas runoffs. What are you looking forward to in next Tuesday's primaries?
Well, I think we've got another sort of establishment versus insurgent primary brewing in Kentucky, in the same way that we were watching Nebraska. We're even more intensely watching Kentucky, given that it's sort of two first-time congressional candidates. Jim Gray, who carried the district in 2016 when he ran for Senate, and he's sort of somebody who's very easily picked up establishment support, donor class support, and he's running against Amy McGrath, who is an insurgent candidate, somebody who, you know, a veteran herself, and somebody who feels like the party should be more reflective of, the leadership should be more reflective of the party that and the voters that they represent. So that's another one to really watch, is to see whether or not sort of more establishment mainstream Democrats line up behind Jim Gray, or if they're more interested in a woman and if she benefits from the boost that we've seen women get throughout the last couple of primaries. So that's one that I'm keeping an eye on. And then we've got Texas runoffs, which are super exciting, in three highly targeted general election districts, in which two of them, we're going to see what kind of Democrat comes out of there. Texas 7, obviously, is one that has drawn a lot of national attention because of the way that the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, decided to put their thumb on the scales there by releasing some opposition research on one candidate who they hope to keep out of the race, but in fact got into the runoff.
And that's Laura Moser, right?
And that's exactly Laura Moser. And she's running against Lizzie Fletcher. And they're both sort of running campaigns that sort of reflect the larger conversation going on in the Democratic Party right now, which is how to win in these traditionally Republican seats that Hillary Clinton won. Laura Moser is positing that the way they do that is by expanding the electorate, getting people who have never voted before to vote in a midterm election and to support them, doing it that way. Whereas Lizzie Fletcher would probably, you know, has said that basically you need to work on getting crossover vote, that you need to talk to those voters who have been alienated by Trump and who maybe aren't sure about a Republican in Congress and will maybe vote for a Democrat for the first time in their lives. So that's another one that I'm really interested in seeing what happens.
I think it's also interesting the primaries that you just described as kind of insider versus outsider types, but not necessarily hinging on ideology, more hinging on style and kind of political theories as opposed to policy positions. There are some ways in which Laura Moser is more a little bit more to the left than Lizzie Fletcher on healthcare, for example. But it's not, you know, it's not a totally cut and dry thing.
Right. Exactly. It's much more about style and strategy than it is about ideology or positions.
Charlie, and I know that you're obsessed with what's going on in a lot of the districts that have these big primaries on next Tuesday. We've got Metro Atlanta, we've got Metro Houston, Metro Dallas. You've talked and written a lot about these suburbs that swung from Romney in 2012 to Clinton in 2016. And, you know, the extent to which we might expect that transformation to continue and how far Democrats are going to be able to lean in to that on the congressional level, where, unlike a lot of the special elections we've seen in 2017, early 2018, they're going to be running against incumbents who have their own brands, who might support Trump in Congress in a lot of ways, but who aren't Trump.
Right. We'll see some signals of that next week, but it's not a day on May 22nd, those primaries. It's not a day where we'll see a ton of it, though. I mean, we will see some action in the Texas suburbs, which I think a lot of people haven't really noticed, but they responded very negatively to Donald Trump in 2016. Not enough to necessarily vote for Hillary Clinton in many of them, although she ran extremely well for a national Democrat in those suburbs, as we've talked about at length, including in the Houston area. But we'll see some Texas suburban action. We'll see some Metro Atlanta action and some signals about what's going to happen in November. But I think the big day that I'm really looking forward to is the following, well, actually 2 weeks hence, the June 5th primaries, where we have probably the biggest primary day of the year, including California and New Jersey, where there are, you know, there are almost probably at least a half dozen suburban seats that will be competitive, and maybe even more in November in those two states alone. And those two states alone can provide almost half the seats, you know, or at least somewhere over somewhere close to half the seats that Democrats would need to win back the majority in the fall.
I'm really looking forward to that, too. And by that point, Elena will have finished her magical mystery tour of the May and June primary states, and we'll have been able to come home for a little while. Elena, thank you so much for jumping on the phone from Texas. Keep an eye out for her story on Texas 7 and some of the other races going on there before next Tuesday's primary. Elena, good luck with your reporting on the road.
Yeah, well, think of me in the 98 degree heat here.
Will do. All right, we'll leave it there. Before we move on to our next segment, I should say we have a way to follow how female candidates are doing in 2018, which we've been spending so much time talking about. It's called the Women Rule Candidate Tracker. Women Rule is this story and podcast series that Politico has going. It's something that Politico is doing, the tracker, in conjunction with the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers and the Women in Public Service Project at the Wilson Center. So check out the Women Rule Candidate Tracker at politico.com. We'll have our next data point in a second, but first, this break.
Alex Azar is Donald Trump's point person on lowering drug prices, and he's a former pharmaceutical executive. So I asked Azar, what do your former colleagues in the pharma industry think of you now?
I really don't care, honestly. You know, I'm here to serve the American people in this job. That is the only thing that I care about.
I'm Dan Diamond, the host of Politico's Pulse Check podcast, looking at healthcare politics and policy. For the rest of that conversation with HHS Secretary Azar, search for Politico's Pulse Check on your favorite podcast player.
We have major breaking news right now. The U.S. Justice Department has just named a special counsel in the Russia investigation.
On to our next data point, which is one. As in 1 year, that's how long the Robert Mueller probe into Russian meddling in the 2016 election has been going. We are marking the anniversary by having on one of the many Politico reporters following the story. Josh Gerstein, good to have you back.
Hey, great to be back with you guys.
Josh, you're into the nitty-gritty of this stuff, and I know we're hearing a lot from the White House and from Trump's lawyers about how they think it is or maybe should be wrapping up. But what do we know?
Well, they're continuing to interview people. Mueller's team is. We know that there are more grand jury subpoenas that have gone out just in the last couple of weeks for people to appear this week. So if this investigation is really wrapping up, I can't tell you that there's like external signs of that. It is kind of logical, though, that if they're into the part of the process where they're talking about interviewing the president, that would seem to suggest that they're coming to a conclusion. You know, what people mean by the investigation wrapping up is also another issue of some debate. I mean, folks should remember we have two separate criminal trials currently scheduled for Paul Manafort, one in Virginia and one in D.C. In past cases, we've thought about the investigation as going on until those kinds of proceedings are over. That's not going to be over with for months and months to come. And if you count appeals and possible convictions, a year or more. But I think it is possible that within the matter of the next few months, Mueller may bring the bulk of his work on this investigation to a close, save for those pending legal matters.
It's interesting following this as a reader, and I'm sure for you as a reporter, just because it seems, and I think this is why a lot of the conversation about this has been how long the probe has been going on as opposed to what it's been doing lately, because the flow of information is so asymmetrical. It seems so much of it comes from people called as witnesses or suspects or their lawyers, as opposed to the people doing the investigation. Right? Like in a lot of ways, like Mueller himself is operating in a black box a little bit.
Right. I mean, I don't know who everyone's sources are who are reporting on this investigation, but there have been very precious few, if any, stories that you can directly point to as being, well, this is leaked from investigators working for Mueller or Mueller's office themselves. Almost all the stories that have come out have a plausible explanation in terms of sourcing, as you're suggesting, from defense attorneys, from witnesses. I've talked to witnesses. Some witnesses have come out and spoken publicly in court about what it was like to go in front of the grand jury or what it was like to be interviewed at Mueller's headquarters. So you're quite correct that we're getting a distorted view of the Mueller investigation in several ways. Obviously, those people who are speaking to us have their own biases and their own desires and their own grudges that they may be settling in some of the things that they say. And they just don't know what's going on behind the curtain. They see a little bit of the curtain when Mueller's people ask them questions. But these are not like show and tell exercises where Mueller people like pull the cover off the blackboard and start pointing at different things and saying, well, here's what we've learned so far. It does not work that way. And I think we've seen evidence of that in the last couple weeks when we get these revelations, as came out, for example, with the Michael Cohen payments, President Trump's lawyer, that, you know, he had been hired by firms like Novartis and AT&T soon after the president was elected and paid large sums, hundreds of thousands of dollars. Not only did we find out that Mueller had looked into that, but we found out that these inquiries went out to the firms. I think the dates were like October or November of last year. That's more than 6 months ago in an investigation that's been very thoroughly covered by the press. So my sense is that there are large chunks of this iceberg that are just rolling along under the water without us knowing about it.
That's such a good point. That's such a good point. Well, you spoke about, you know, behind the curtain a little bit. You wrote a very interesting story this morning, kind of peeling back the curtain a little bit on who the people involved in this investigation are and what their expertise and past experience is on the FBI side.
Yeah, so I thought there had been a lot of coverage of the prosecutors and who they are, and we almost know like what breakfast cereal they like to eat. Just very intense coverage of each prosecutor who has been added to Mueller's team. And, you know, I've done some of those stories, so I'm not saying they shouldn't have been done, but I feel like there's been much less coverage of beyond the you know, sensational headlines about Pete Strzok, the former agent who was having an affair and was texting and so forth and was removed from the case. Who else the FBI has assigned and Mueller has hired or brought on for this investigation? And so over the last, I would say, really 9 months, as I've been hanging out at the courthouse for various grand jury meetings and various court hearings, I've been trying to keep an eye on who are these agents that are flowing in and out, who are the names that keep appearing in court documents as pivotal to the Manafort investigation, to the Russian trolls investigations, to other parts of this Mueller probe. And just to try to note those names and then go back through social media, press releases, media accounts, what have these people been involved in before? And I think we get a kind of an interesting picture of a pretty diverse group of people, some who do public corruption investigations, some who do more traditional accounting kind of fraud, business fraud maybe, and even some who are more in the cyber front. And try to look at who those agents are and what kinds of backgrounds they're bringing to this work.
Josh, sometimes it seems like to outside people, outside the media, that what we do is so opaque, and the process of reporting out a story like this is so confusing to them. Can you give some examples of? I love that story this morning, and when I read it. Can you talk a little bit about how did you start? What's the first thing you do? Talk about how you report out that story.
Well, first, it came from the idea of actually going to these hearings and sitting there and thinking, gee, this is an imbalance that we know everything about the people sitting at this table, but not the people sitting in this row of seats that are here doing the same kind of work. It reminded me a little bit of the opening to Law and Order where they say, you know, the people are represented by two different groups. They're kind of working together more in the Mueller investigation than they do in New York City, but it is the prosecutors and the police, and the FBI in this situation are the police. So it's a question of when names are blurted out at these hearings. Sometimes they introduce the FBI agent at the hearing. I don't think most reporters even write the name down, but it's in the transcript and you can go and pull it and see. And then every time there's a document or a filing, people may remember Paul Manafort got into some trouble for an op-ed that he was trying to write while he was under a gag order by the judge. Well, there are some affidavits that were filed with the court and they're all signed by an FBI agent. And his name happens to be Brock Doman, and you can go just try to figure out who that person is. It's not a very common name, and you can eventually figure out what his background is and that he's a pretty, I think, atypical FBI agent, somebody who came out of the movie business and was a sort of a video editor or in post-production work and some kind of computer work and ended up going to the FBI. So it's really running those things down, and then there is a source-based element to it, which is trying to talk to the witnesses and trying to talk to lawyers for witnesses and other people who have interacted with the FBI investigators. How did they behave? How much did they talk? How much did the prosecutors talk? You know, was there anything strange they did? Did they like pick you up a couple blocks away from the office and take you in and to try to get some of the color of what it's like to interact with these men and women who are actually doing much of the legwork for Mueller's probe.
I have to admit the shallowness of this question in advance. All I could think of as I was reading your story was how similar are these agents to the kind of agents we see on TV?
So I don't think they're that similar. I mean, you know, TV tends to glamorize everything and make it more sensational, right? And more exciting, certainly, than investigating any business fraud is not that exciting because you spend a lot of time poring over paperwork.
Well, there was an anecdote about this in your story, right? You found a video of an interrogation that one of these FBI agents conducted.
Correct.
In which he discusses this.
So while I was working on this story, I was Googling one of the names involved one day and found out that the Daily News up in New York had just posted a video of a couple FBI agents involved in a very interesting interrogation a couple years ago, year and a half, 2 years ago, with a suspect in an NYPD bribery case in which he was drinking heavily during this early Sunday morning interrogation, but they just sort of went on with the interview anyway, as if nothing was happening, as the guy put away glass after glass of vodka and then wine. And so while going through that, I identified that one of these agents seemed to be the same guy who was working on the Mueller investigation. I was able to get from a source the video of that entire interrogation, which lasts about 2.5 hours. And in it, you hear this agent, Jason Alberts, talking with the suspect. The suspect says he's a fan of the show Billions on Showtime. And he said, and Alberts responds, look, life for an FBI agent isn't anything like what you see on TV. Or I wish what happened to me at Quantico was like the TV show Quantico, but it's not like that at all. We're mostly dealing with pretty sophisticated people. It's not a lot of gangbangers and drug dealers. So that gives you a sense of the types of cases these FBI agents are working and how their lives are probably a little bit different from TV and also a little bit different from cops working violent crimes.
It's so interesting. And it just, like you said, it kind of pulls back the curtain on like a little bit of why, like you said, stuff can happen 8 months ago that we have no idea about still as we're thinking about this investigation and trying to puzzle out and see where it might be going. It's so interesting. There was news this week from one of the other investigations into Russian meddling. Republicans and Democrats on the Senate Intelligence Committee released, you know, a whole bunch of documents and said, it's like, yes, you know, Russians interfered to help Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential election. That's different than what we saw from the House Intelligence Committee, but is it surprising at all? It's backing up what we've seen from the intelligence community and elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, the Senate investigation into the Trump-Russia affair has been generally a more bipartisan investigation. There's been a more, I think, equity in the way that probe has been handled. The House one has devolved into just finger pointing.
Might be finger biting.
It could
too,
be finger biting. You know, at one point, remember in the House Intelligence Committee, they like were going to put up a wall to try to physically separate the Republicans from the Democrats. So perhaps there was a risk of physical violence. But you know, the Senate probe has been more cordial, I think, and the two senators who are running it have tried to get along, I think, better. That's Burr and Warner have tried to get along better than the House members have managed to. You know, it added some interesting information. We got a bunch of transcripts in addition to this report about some of the interviews and back and forth about what Donald Trump Jr. had said and things along those lines. I'm not sure there were huge revelations to it, but it was interesting that the Senate panel disputed sort of what the House Republicans had said and sort of what the White House line has been that, you know, well, the whatever Russia was up to, maybe they were just making trouble. They weren't trying to actually get Trump elected, and said they actually were trying to get Trump elected.
Josh, last thing before we finish up here, what's kind of the next big development that you're looking for? You mentioned Paul Manafort's about to go on trial. Is that kind of the next big thing that we've got pending, or is there something else that you've got your eye out for developing soon?
Probably the next big thing that will be happening is the release of the Inspector General's report at the Justice Department misconduct there related to the Clinton email investigation. Remember, we only got a little glimpse at that when Andrew McCabe was fired a month or two ago. They told us a little bit about what the IG had concluded about him. He was the deputy director of the FBI. But the vast majority of that investigation into politicization of the FBI during the 2016 election, into potential leaks from offices of the FBI, especially the New York and Little Rock offices of the FBI during the 2016 election. These are all matters that the Justice Department Inspector General has been investigating now for about 16 or 17 months. So we're expecting a fairly massive report accompanied by testimony from the Inspector General, which I think is likely sometime probably the first week of June.
All right. Can't wait to see what happens next on this front. Can't wait to see what you write next, Josh. Great reporting on this story out today. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Scott and Charlie. Thanks for having me on.
And Charlie, thank you, as always, for being here.
Scott, thanks so much for having me.
All right, as promised, before we take you out, we are going to turn things over briefly to one Nerdcast superfan. Chris Ninian of London, hey, another transatlantic listener, is going to help us out with the credits this week. Chris, take it away.
Nerdcast is produced by Michaela Rodriguez, with help this week from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is the executive producer, and the illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, rate the show and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show.
Thank you, Chris. Listeners, we found Chris because he emailed in to say he was a fan. If you are a fan of the Nerdcast who wants to read the credits, let us know. Shoot an email to nerdcast@politico.com. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.